This is HPR episode 1747 entitled, Scale 13x Part 4 of 6. It is hosted by Lord Rationlut, and is about 53 minutes long. The summary is, 5 interviews from Scale X13.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Greetings, Hacker Public Radio, Lord Drakenblut at Scale 13X, and currently I am at the Pearlmongers of Southern California booth. And who do I have the pleasure of speaking with today?
Hi, my name is Mark Nagel.
Marco Palma from OpenX.
David McDuffie.
Now, who are or what is Pearlmongers of Southern California?
Well, Pearlmongers in general is basically a collection of groups that all basically do a lot of Perl programming and Perl aficionados involved in either development for actual companies or for projects or just for fun. And so all over the country, all over the world, there's Perlmongers organizations.
So if people are interested in the Perlmongers in general, where should they go to find out more information?
Well, the main website is pm.org, right?
Yeah,
pm.org. Yeah, pm.org is the main site.
And it has a list of all the local Perlmongers groups. I typically attend Los Angeles Perlmongers meetings, which happen either in near the Santa Monica, Venice area, or sometimes in downtown LA.
Now, what is kind of the goal that Perlmongers have in general?
I would say in general, just to spread the general knowledge about Perl, let people learn from each other, and just a general sort of club, right? Just to make sure everybody who's involved in Perl has somebody else to talk to, bend their ears, learn from each other.
Now, how long have you been involved with Perlmongers, and how long have you been using Perl?
Well, me personally, I've been involved with Perl for, 20 years, at least. I can't even remember. Perlmongers not as long. I've been involved in the mailing list and talking to people and doing a lot of different conversations and such, but going to meetings hasn't happened as much. And this is actually my first time hosting the booth with these folks this year. So trying to get more involved right now.
And what is it about Perl that keeps you using it over, some other, newer languages or different languages?
Well, there's so many different languages out there, and Perl, I think, got its roots as far as popularity back when the web was sort of young and people were using it for CGI development, and so it got very popular during that time. And during that time, with all those people involved, built this huge infrastructure and ecosystem of modules and reusable code that makes it very, very nice to program in. And Perl itself is a very powerful language. So
now, one thing I'm aware of is Perl has, I believe it's called CPAN. Was it kind of the first language to implement the idea of a language having its own repository, for lack of a better way to put it?
Yeah, I'm not sure if CPAN was the very first repository, but it was definitely one of the most popular ones. It may have been the first. Was CPAN first?
I don't know, but it's still going after all these years. And, there are some other sites which mirror what gets put in CPAN, like Meta CPAN. It has a slightly more modern interface, but CPAN by far is the largest. So,
right, and the idea of CPAN basically that's been duplicated by all the other languages. That they all have their own repositories, and they all use the same concept, or everybody gets to contribute, and everything's well documented, and you can easily install modules. So, I think a lot of people think Perl is sort of dying off, but it's not. It's just there's a lot more languages to choose from, a lot of different things people are involved in that. Point towards different things. We were talking about that earlier. A lot of people get involved in Ruby now because Ruby is used for Chef and for Puppet, and it just depends which tool set you're involved in.
So how did you get started in using Perl?
Well, my first exposure to Perl was when it was Perl 4, before Perl 5 came out. Yeah, look at him. He's like, whoa. And that was just an amazing, it was just an amazing thing compared to working in shell script or C shell script at the time, which is pretty much what you had, or sed or awk. And you got all the, you know, all the things you needed are right there. And so, you know, pretty much from that point on, it was anything of any medium to high complexity needed to be done in Perl, from my perspective.
Now, if someone, you know, interested in getting involved in using scripting languages, programming languages, why do you think they should start with Perl above any of the other options out there?
Well, I'm not sure that that's actually the best thing to say, is that you should say, I'm going to start in Perl just because Perl is good. Perl is good. But I think anybody who's getting involved in any project should look at what they need to do that project with. I mean, it may be Perl, it may be another language. Like I said, there's a lot of choices out there. And I suppose I should be here and say, hey, we're in the Perl booth and you should only do Perl and all those other languages suck. But I don't think that's true. I think every language has its place.
I wasn't trying to insinuate that. I mean, I was just talking more someone who is sitting down for the first time trying to learn how to do, you know, a scripting language in general. That's where I mean the why should they choose Perl over something else? Not someone getting involved with a project, but...
So I have a couple of... I mean, the reason why I use Perl and I enjoy using Perl is really twofold. One is the freedom, because it's a language that's very expressive and it lets you do it however you want. I mean, and the motto is Tim Toti. There's more than one way to do it, right? So it's a language that doesn't get in your way. There's not a lot of strict rules about how you have to format your code, which, you know, some people look at as a detriment, because then all pieces of code could be very different in how they're written and style. But I like the fact that it gives me the freedom to write code the way I think, the way I speak, and it supports very expressing code in a way that's very close to natural language, right? So I can code almost the way I speak, and a lot of other languages don't afford me that freedom. So that and CPAN. I mean, CPAN is like...
It's awesome, yeah. CPAN's very, 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 very handy to have available. Although one of my things is I'm always trying to write my code so I don't have to rely on too many modules, but it's there for you if you need it. When you're doing short, you know, short utilities, you don't want to have to make it dependent on a bunch of modules, but you can, and if you need anything special, it's there. There's tons of stuff built into the language. It's powerful in and of itself, but then there's a bunch of modules that come with it, and you can do many, many things out of the box. But again, yeah, a lot of languages share those features. If you're learning a language from scratch and you're like, I want to learn something interesting, I would choose Perl. I wouldn't say you'd be wrong to choose another language, but Perl is very very expressive, and I would just be careful when you're using it to make sure that you can read it when you're done, because that's one of the complaints people have about Perl, is it's a write-only language. Because people can do it in a way that is hard to read afterwards. But that's just poor programming skills. That's not a language issue.
So, other words, document your shit.
Document your shit. Yes. Yes.
And
use good byte variables and don't rely on the two-character variables. And, you know, there's all sorts of stuff you can do. And that's what people don't like about Perl, I think, is because it allows you to do anything. So it allows you to do things badly or well. So, you know, program well.
I was going to say, you know, for documentation purposes, pod is a great CPAN module, right? If you sprinkle your code with pod-compliant bits of syntax, you can actually get great documentation into your code and out of your code.
That's not even CPAN. That's built in, I think.
Yeah, now that's part of core now. The other thing I wanted to mention was that, you know, Perl, because it's embedded in almost every Linux distribution there is, can be found on all kinds of devices nowadays, you know, from Raspberry Pis to...
My Synology has it, yeah.
All right. Is there anything at this point you would like the HPR audience to know that maybe I've missed in asking?
I cannot think of anything specific. You have anything else you want to add, Mark?
Try it out. Perl 6 should be dropping in December.
So the mythical Perl 6 might finally actually maybe happen?
Larry has said it will be here in December.
For his 61st birthday, so yes. It's virgin.
But also there's the conference in Salt Lake City.
Yes.
And you have the details. I know it's Yahtzee, right?
All right. So just the Perl 6 con or the Perl conference, the details you have available for that, Marco?
They are available at yapcna.org. And that is yet another Perl conference, North America 2015. It's happening in Salt Lake City, Utah, June 8th through 10th.
Papers are due by the end of this month.
All right. And one question I was asked to ask, what is your favorite text editor?
My favorite text editor? I use Vim mostly.
Vim.
All right, folks. Well, this has been Lord Drachenblut at Scale 13X with the gentlemen of the Perl Mongers of Southern California. All right, ladies and gentlemen, Lord Drachenblut still at Scale 13X, and I'm at the Key Cloud booth, if I'm not mistaken. Who do I have the pleasure of speaking with this afternoon?
My name is Chris Tickner. I'm the Director of Marketing for Key Information Systems.
And you, sir? Okay, we'll stick with just this one gentleman. So it is Key Cloud. I didn't get that incorrect.
Yeah, it's Key Cloud. So Key Clouds are one of our products that we sell. It's an enterprise hybrid cloud.
All right. So what is the goal of Key Cloud? What are you guys trying to accomplish exactly?
Let me bring in Clayton here too.
All right.
Clayton, for a podcast.
Oh wow.
So the question is, what is Key Cloud's goal? What is it trying to accomplish?
Oh, that's an interesting one. So the goal is to provide cloud services for enterprise, for clients looking for enterprise class service. How can I put this? Our target client is mid-market to large enterprise, and then we're going to be shifting that in over the next few months to also focus on startups as well. But it's to be able to provide reliable and secure cloud services to that type of customer looking for something.
So you guys are probably built on top of a lot of free and open source software. What projects do you guys use, and what projects have you possibly created and put out to the community?
Okay, so I was a contributor to CloudStack, which is a cloud orchestration tool, and then we are actually in the middle of our OpenStack rollout. One of the things we're doing this year is expanding to get more open source software to run on IBM's power systems, because we think the chipset is superior to Intel. And so we're actually going to be, we're developing our own database as a service, sort of like Amazon RDS, but based on the IBM Power chipset to provide better performance than what people would get on an Intel platform.
Now, this new database, is that going to be something that's FOSS to some extent completely, or is it going to be something closed and people will only be able to use?
No, it's all... So everything for us is open standards, open APIs, and open base. So we're not developing a new database. What we're doing is providing a way to provision and manage database clusters and those things on top of what we think is a superior hardware platform. So Postgres, MySQL, MariaDB, well, not as much MySQL because of the split away there. But those open source types of applications, Mongo, Cassandra, all to be running on this hardware platform with, you know, using OpenStack and CloudStack APIs to be able to provision and manage those things. It's all, but everything is open standards based. We don't want to have any sort of hardware. We don't want any proprietary technology.
Now, what projects have you guys created? Any projects that people could go out, you know, grab and use themselves on their own systems?
Not yet. So that's part of what we're doing with developing this platform for the database as a service, is to be able to have that and have that available to the community.
So people will be able to, if they really wanted to, be able to go out, recreate, or kind of recreate what you guys are doing, but then you guys are kind of, you know, you're kind of the Cadillac of the service, where people want a complete, fully integrated system where they don't have to think about it. They come to you guys and you help them make it all happen, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So it would be, it's a mix, right? So there's the part where we would provide all the hosting and the management and those services, or it, whether it's that a client hits a certain scale that it doesn't make sense for them to do a fully managed solution, or it's that they want to do it themselves, we'll provide them with all the same tool sets and everything that we did it on.
Okay, and what do you think it is about the IBM Power 8, you said?
Yeah.
What makes that better than just using, you know, commodity Intel or AMD?
There are a number of things. One is they have an alternative to FPGA, which is much easier to develop on, called Kappy. So if you're doing, yeah.
And what's an FPGA for people who may not know?
It's a field programmable gateway interface, and it's a type of hardware interface, kind of like what you would use if you were building something to be spun onto silicon. So instead of using a generic processor like you would with a regular, you know, CPU of some sort, if you wanted to develop something in ASIC, FPGA is a way to program with that type of hardware level speed. IBM has their alternative to that called Kappy, which is also open standards based and open source and available. So one of the reasons why we like the Power8 chipset is that. And the other is, from a hardware architecture standpoint, on a standard commodity box, you have what's called an I.O. bridge that sits between the memory and the processor, and you're limited to 16 gigs per second on that I.O. bridge. In the case of the power systems, they have removed the I.O. bridge. So you go from 16 gigs per second up to 96 gigs per second. And that's really important when you talk about in-memory databases. So things like what you might do with Redis or Cassandra, MySQL, or Mongo, where you're going to have a lot of tables stored in memory, you get much faster transactions on the power system. So for us, for those types of database workloads that are very memory intensive, Power provides a much, much better price-performance ratio than Intel.
All right. And if people want to get involved or learn more about Key Cloud, where should they go?
They can just go to keycloud.com or to the keyinfo.com website, and they can contact us on the phone numbers there.
All right. Now, I noticed at your booth, you guys are showing off another really interesting piece of technology. What are you guys showing off today?
Yeah, so we have a pair of Oculus Rifts that are up. We thought it was just a really cool technology, and we've always been a big fan of it. I was a contributor to the original Kickstarter project. So we've got two of the DevKit 2s up and running here for people to, you know, try out and just and, you know, see what it is. I think there's some pretty cool implications for technology beyond just gaming, but it's just great as entertainment. And I, you know, we just want to. It's just a blast. It's just to get people out here and have some fun.
What do you think of the fact that the DK2 is basically, if I remember correctly, a Galaxy S5 minus the phone components? If you open that up, there are actually a lot of the pieces that's, you know, you would. It's actually the same motherboard that's in the Galaxy S5, I believe.
I mean, there were one of the main differences between DK2 and DK1 was the board aside, actually, the primary difference was they switched the screen type and they went from LCD to AMOLED, and that let them get much better tracking and it got rid of a lot of the problems of simulation sickness. But it shows in the fact that Samsung has their own product they're coming out with. I mean, we're going to see, you know, multiple versions of these things as different manufacturers come out with their own. I'm really curious to see what Razer does with theirs and all the different headsets, but...
All right. Anything you want to add or you think I've overlooked for the HPR audience?
No, I think it's a pretty good overview of what we're doing here and what we're trying to represent and our support of the open source community. And yeah.
All right. Well, this is Lord Dragonblue at Scale 13X with the Key Cloud booth. Thank you. All right, Hacker Public Radio, this is Lord Drakenblut at Scale 13X still, and currently I'm at the Girls in Tech LA booth, and who do I have the pleasure of speaking with today?
Hi, my name is Muriel Perez, and I'm the Managing Director of the Los Angeles chapter of Girls in Tech. I do this on a volunteer basis, and by day I work as the IT admin in a manufacturing company.
Now, what is... Girls in Tech, and what is its goals?
So, Girls in Tech is a global nonprofit. Each chapter operates to address the local tech community, and we're basically here to create a positive space for women that are either working in or interested in technology. And so we'll do that just by bringing this community together, hosting everything from social events to tech workshops. But a big part of what we do is bringing that community back to mentor and work to empower young girls of all ages to pursue interests in technology.
And what do you see as being the big hurdles right now in getting more women involved in tech?
Well, I guess I'll kind of address this in a slightly different way, more than the hurdles, because there are a lot of different reasons and a lot of different backgrounds as to why we don't see as many women in tech. And I think what we're looking to do is just encourage more women by having this space where people can go and feel comfortable. It's like, for example, if there's a group of, pick some topic that you've got absolutely no interest in, like MMA or horse racing or whatever. If you go into this group and you don't have anybody that you can relate to, then you're less likely to go there. So if a girl, I guess, backing up, if a girl never sees another woman that is a coder or an engineer or working in tech or working in IT or working in system security, they're a lot less likely to be able to pursue that because they don't identify with anyone in that role or they don't understand that. So the more we can provide positive role models for girls of all ages, the more we can encourage them to pursue technology when they grow up.
Now, at one time, women seemed to be much more important in computers and programming, especially when you go back to some of the earlier days, and especially if you look at someone like Lady Ada Lovelace. But it seems like there was a sharp decline in that. What do you think might have caused that decline?
I guess maybe going back to just the media and perception, if we don't see a lot more of this. I mean, there was a lot of really awesome stuff with women in computing, and you saw during the war and when computing was first getting started, a lot of engineers and a lot of programmers that were involved in hands-on in that space. But I think not having enough visibility for women that are in the tech space to be able to encourage women to both stay in there and also more girls to pursue that kind of impacts us just mentally by forming these biases that I don't see as many women there, people just are sort of internally less likely to be able to pursue or go that direction.
So if I'm understanding things right, in a lot of ways you see it as that it's a perception issue is one of the biggest problems.
Yes, I think you could say that that's one of the big things.
And now what would you say about the way some people are portraying current climates, and to use the really one of the worst examples right now is the whole Gamergate situation, and how other cases it'll seem like a woman who is involved in tech or in different things will get a lot of questions that a man who said the same thing would never get those kind of questions.
So I guess backing up so I understand the question, you kind of wanted me to address just what was going on with Gamergate and a lot of the current attitudes towards women and technology?
I was just using Gamergate as an example, not per se them, but just how some people seem to be really pushing the idea that there is just a very hostile climate towards women in technology in general.
In certain ways, yes, there can be a hostile space, but it's one of those things that it's very dependent on personal experience. So there are some women that have experienced a lot of hostility and a lot of negativity that have gotten trolled and taken down and death threats and all these crazy things online. And there are other women that haven't. And I think what is important is for the community together to be able to address and support people across their range of experiences. So to support women that have seen very hostile feedback, have gotten, really, really negative comments online and in person and all of this other stuff, and then also the people that have had positive experiences, if that makes sense. So I think it's more like, as a community, can we come together and make sure that if there are instances of negative things happening, that they're addressed appropriately so that they continue not to happen, or that if people are being treated poorly, that it's either addressed at the source of that bad behavior or wherever it's coming from. If we can kind of target that and stop what's going on.
All right. Is there anything else you would like the Hacker Public Radio audience to know that maybe I've missed at this point?
I think that we've covered that. I think the big thing is that if you are interested in getting more girls or women in tech, to just do some outreach to your community, to girls of all ages, to schools, to work hands-on with kids, to be able to encourage and excite them about technology. There are a lot of fun things about technology. There are some negative things that happen, but there's also a lot of positive stuff that's out there. And so I think if we focus on a lot of the positive things and also try to battle as a community against the negative stuff that's happening, that it'll be a better place for everybody.
Now, what would be ways you might say are good ways to help excite a younger generation about being involved in technology?
Just having group events, hands-on events, you know, I think games are a really great way to get kids excited. I think bringing kids into tech events like Scale so that they can see what's out there and what's available.
And maybe one other thing is break the stereotypes of, you know, this is for boys, this is for girls. That would be
I mean, there are a lot of stereotypes out there that are, like, it's this, the mass marketing media machine kind of pushes a lot of that stuff. It's everything from the types of toys and the types of activities that are marketed towards girls versus the stuff that's marketed towards boys. I think if we can get more things like Boldy Blocks, for example, which encourages girls to start learning how to engineer, and if we can get other things like that out there where girls and boys can work on tech and on programming and on code.
Now, see, when I was younger, I can remember a time when Legos were Legos, Lincoln Logs were Lincoln Logs. There was no separation of the idea of this was a boy's toy or a girl's toy. And in some respects, for me, and I'd love to hear your response to this, seeing that they now create Lego blocks for girls, the only difference is, oh, they're pink and frilly. And, you know, it seems like there is this bizarre thing where all of a sudden it has to be made what some people would, you know, say as, you know, a feminine color or something like that to be a girl's toy, and I just don't understand it, and maybe you have an insight on it that I'm missing.
You know, it's a really funny thing, and I think it's kind of the way that just the media has over-commercialized and marketed holidays, for example. Like, they feel like they have to brand it in a certain way. And so now when you get these companies coming in, they're like, oh, if we're going to market something to girls, it has to be pink. You know, like you said, it has to be princess or it has to be frilly. Which, yeah, there are a lot. Like, I love pink and all of these other things also, but it doesn't have to be marketed as pink for me to enjoy it. And so I think if we do have things that are marketed as unisex, that would be a great thing. I think the problem was just that there's a lot of stuff now that gets marketed towards boys, and so sort of the contrast is, let's make this stuff pink to be a girl's toy. But I think we can definitely have a lot of toys and activities out there that are marketed towards kids that girls and boys can play on or work on together, and that it doesn't have to be segregated or separated out into this sort of female space or a male space. It's sort of a community space where people with shared interests can get together. And if that means that girls and guys are into computing and tech and Legos, or girls and guys can be interested in like My Little Pony, or girls and guys can be interested in princesses, it's across the board. These are things that don't necessarily have to be gendered one way or another. It's just about what are you interested in and how can we support you pursuing that interest.
All right. Well, I think that covers a lot of different grounds pretty well. Is there anything else you could think of you would like to say before we finish?
No, just thank you for your time and for thinking of us. And check us out online at girlsintechla.org.
And if people wanted to reach Girls in Tech in general, where would they go?
The main Girls in Tech website is at girlsintech.org.
All right. Well, this has been Lord Drachenflute at Scale 13X. with the wonderful ladies from Girls in Tech LA branch. All right, Hacker Public Radio, it's Lord Drachenblut at Scale 13X still, and I am here with Snowdrift.coop, or co-op, sorry. And who do I have the ability to talk to?
This is Aaron Wolf. I'm the co-founder and, I guess, main project manager of Snowdrift.coop.
Now, what is Snowdrift.coop? What's its goals? What's it trying to achieve?
We're building a cooperative web platform for the community to help projects that are freely licensed reach their potential. So unlike proprietary projects that have a business model in which you can do pay for access or put ads on everything, freely licensed projects are public goods that everybody can access and everybody benefits from the results and uses freely regardless of whether they contributed to the development. So there's a public goods dilemma of how do you fund such projects when everybody gets the results no matter what.
Well, in some newer cases, crowdfunding seems to be a popular method and, you know, the donation model. What's that sets Snowdrift.coop apart from, you know, a crowdfunding model or the traditional just donation model or selling services around a product?
We're adding to that by kind of pushing to the next level. The term crowdfunding in general means just that you have a lot of people, a crowd, and they're funding. And so in that sense, we are crowdfunding, but we're not crowdfunding like Kickstarter where you do a one-time fund drive. There's a number of problems with such one-time fund drives where you have an artificial deadline and some arbitrary goal, and if you don't hit the goal, you get nothing, and it costs a lot, you do a lot of hype, and maybe some people don't even hear about it by the time the deadline comes. Those types of things are really good for one-time initiatives or for getting launched. In fact, we don't have our own system to use yet because we're not fully launched, so we ran our own Kickstarter-style threshold campaign last December, which was a success. But it was a lot of work, and it's not a very sustainable way to have a system working. So when people do sustaining pledges where they contribute on an ongoing basis, there's more accountability and you generally have a more reliability as a project. But still, even with that type of donation or any type of simple one person unilateral donation, it doesn't solve this dilemma. And so the public goods challenge is something we're talking about as the Snowdrift dilemma, which is something we learned about from a game theory. Essentially, there's a snowdrift blocking the road, this obstacle that we need to clear, and the question is, who's going to do the work? Everybody benefits from the road being cleared, and maybe everybody would like to wait and see if somebody else will do the work to clear it. At some level, it's about cooperation, which, hence Snowdrift.coop, and in conjunction with that, we're also running as a nonprofit cooperative, as a platform. So our solution...
So in part, it sounds like you're creating more of a membership style means of funding projects.
Yes. But membership style is good in and of itself, but it misses what Kickstarter style has, which is a mutual assurance in which we say, I'm not just going to go it alone. I need help from everybody else to make this worthwhile. So we're a combination of both of those in which I say, I will contribute a little bit each month for every additional person who will contribute with me. So at a minimum level, I might say I'll contribute a tenth of a cent for each person who's contributing with me. If there's 1,000 people, I'll put in $1, but if there's 5,000 people, I'll put in $5. When the rest of the community joins me, it's more worthwhile for me to put in what I can, because together we make a bigger difference.
Now, would people still have the option to say, I just want to donate $5 a month, $5 a year?
We don't stop any of the projects from using any traditional funding system as long as it's consistent with being freely licensed. So we don't want pay for access, but if they have a service-based model or they have a donation button on their website, we're not stopping them from doing that. But in our system, the message is your donation will make a bigger difference if you tell the rest of the world that you want them to join you than if you just give all you can right away. If you give all you can right away, then it's not an incentive. It doesn't provide that invitation to the rest of the community. We need to get freely licensed projects like free software supported by a lot more than the developer community. We need to reach out to the general public and get a lot more people involved in supporting these projects that we can all then benefit from.
Very, very interesting. So what level are you guys up and operational to at this point?
We are testing with fake money at the moment. We have a few hundred people who've been involved in the community in a loose sense and a handful of active volunteers. And we're talking with lawyers and accountants right now about getting all of the details for handling money in place. And we hope to be actually operating probably in the next few months.
And what license are you guys using for the platform you're building?
We are licensed under the GNU Afero General Public License, the AGPL. And our work that is not code, but is like the wiki writing pages on our site, the writings and illustrations, are under the Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike license. So those are both strong copyleft licenses. But we're deferring to the existing organizations for the licenses that projects can use. So any project that uses a license accepted by the FSF or the OSI or the Definition of Free Cultural Works or the Open Definition from the Open Knowledge Foundation, any of those accepted licenses will be fine for the projects that want to use the site.
And why did you guys choose the AGPL V3?
We wanted to make it sure that everything we were doing would be usable for everybody else and consistent with our values for free licensing. But our interest is in protecting that freedom so that when anybody else were to use our work, they would be still contributing to the commons that we can all benefit from and that respect everyone's freedoms.
So, and also the AGPL V3, say someone creates a similar site to you and someone joins that, they can still get access to the code, the changes someone else makes on another site.
Sure, this is a little bit of a simplification, but I think of it as the GPL has a loophole. The GPL says you can use this code, but you have to keep it free and you have to keep respecting the freedoms for other people you distribute the code to. But people can say, oh, I didn't distribute the software to you because I just let you use it over a server. So the Afero clause closes that loophole, and so it does a better job of protecting everyone's freedoms.
All right. Now, is there anything you think I've missed at this point that you would like the HPR audience to know?
Well, the main thing to know is that anybody who likes what we're doing or even has constructive feedback that they would like to share, you can come visit snowdrift.coop, and we're on freenode.net IRC at Snowdrift. So come say hi. We're a very welcoming community, and we really are hoping that we'll have some real impact in the world. So we hope people help us get there.
And if people want to, what kind of help do you guys need right now to get up and operational?
Well, the most valuable help is probably helping us code the website. So if you want to learn or know already some Haskell, because we're written with the Yasode web framework, which is written in Haskell, that's one way. But I'm not a programmer myself, and I've been doing lots of work on writings. We can do translations to different languages. We could have legal help with some of the finances and the organizational things, handling volunteers, welcoming people even. There's a lot of different things that are happening with building this whole community around this project.
And if people want to get involved, as you said, IRC and the website, so people are understand fully, it is snowdrift.coop, correct?
That's right. .coop is a sponsored top-level domain. It's exclusively for legitimately cooperative organizations. which is what we're doing. So everything we will do will be run by the community as a in a democratic fashion, as a cooperative.
All right. Well, this has been Lord Drakenblut at Scale 13X with Aaron from Snowdrift.coop. All right, this is Lord Drakenblut at Scale 13X, and I'm at the SaltStack booth. And who do I have the pleasure of talking to?
My name is Seth House. I'm an engineer at SaltStack.
All right, so for people, to fill people in, what is SaltStack?
Salt is a high-speed communication bus that is something you would use to manage your infrastructure. What that high-speed bus allows you to do is things like remote execution, things like command and control, things like configuration management, things like high-level orchestration where you need things to happen in sequences of steps or, you know, optionally fail on certain things, things like reacting to live events and taking either corrective action or, you know, whatever else you need to do. It is a high-speed communication bus that is very open-ended in what you can use it for.
All right, so Salt kind of falls into the recent DevOps movement. What other tools are out there in that space, and what sets Salt apart from the others?
So Salt has an awful lot of overlap with a lot of the tools in this space, but it's a very different kind of tool for the reason that we've got this communication bus at the core. So although Salt overlaps with tools like Puppet or Chef, Salt also works very well with tools like Puppet or Chef. If you are an existing Puppet shop, for example, you use Salt to orchestrate Puppet. You use Salt to integrate with Puppet into that existing tool. So that is one place that Salt differentiates, and that it integrates very well with all sorts of systems. It's also a different approach to solving these sorts of problems because once you have a finger on the pulse of your infrastructure, you start to approach problems differently. It kind of unites things like data discovery and command and control with things like monitoring or auto-scaling and that sort of thing. All of that's within the purview of Salt, if you don't mind me being too open-ended about it.
Oh, by all means, be as verbose as you want. The worst that happens is I fall asleep with the recorder held up in the air and you get to keep talking.
I like it.
Now, why would someone get involved using something like Salt? What would be, you know, the motivation for someone to use something like Salt in general?
Sure. It usually starts with a problem that needs solving, oftentimes the considerations that go into that problem are things like whether or not the software is open source, whether or not it can be modified, whether or not you can customize it or build additions on top of it. And Salt facilitates all of those things. It's got several APIs for getting data into and out of Salt. It's got a module system, so the modules that ship with Salt Core are on the same footing as modules that you would write to solve a custom problem if you have a custom problem. It is a very, very pluggable system by design and a very scalable system by design. So, yep.
Well, I guess the question, and I phrased it a little bad because I don't think I quite got the answer to what I was looking for. Why would someone start using Salt instead of just configuring a machine by hand or custom, you know, shell scripts?
Sure. Oftentimes that's the place that most people start, and oftentimes what people run into when they do that are they get tired of having to build out every custom little thing, every single time they want something that has been pre-built out for them. Or oftentimes they run into problems with scaling. You know, a custom shell script or an SSH in a for loop works, you know, when you've got 5 servers or 10 servers. And once you start to get above that, then you're in for a bit of a wait. If you're trying to configure a machine or if you're trying to pull data for a machine, then that process takes a little time. And one of the neat things about Salt's pluggable interface is, say you did start with those things, you can use Salt to call into those existing scripts, those existing processes, and you can phase them out over time as you phase in Salt. When you go to build new things, we've got pre-written modules and formulas to work with existing tools, both to get data out of them, to get data into them, to configure them, and so Salt will help you avoid having to reinvent that wheel yet again.
And Salt can almost in a lot of ways turn the machine you're configuring into code.
Yeah, that's a nice way to say it. We configure Salt by putting together data structures. And how you generate those data structures is entirely up to you. If you enjoy writing YAML and Jinja, that's our default. If you'd rather write Python, that's easily done. If you'd rather write Ruby, it's not out of the realm of possibility. So we aim to be flexible. We say infrastructure as data, and that is both incoming and outgoing. You configure Salt using data. You pull data out of your infrastructure into Salt for things like reporting or that sort of thing.
And Salt can also help with security in your infrastructure, can it? By making things more automated, more programmatic, and more repeatable.
Exactly right. Having your systems set up to a known configuration, knowing that they're configured with the latest version of OpenSSL or that sort of thing, is definitely within the purview of Salt. And not only making Salt set it up that way, but querying your infrastructure to find out what is vulnerable. Say the latest exploit comes out, Shellshock or Heartbleed or something like that. Querying your infrastructure is as simple as running a single command that then goes out and returns results almost instantly to you about what is vulnerable on your infrastructure. PCI requirements, same kind of thing. Ask your infrastructure what is its current state, what it's vulnerable to, and get a report back immediately that you can take some action on.
And speaking of states, isn't Salt capable of going through at a set interval and making sure a machine is still at the state you set it at?
Yeah, well said. We're pretty open-ended in that, too. So you can set Salt to run on a schedule. So you can say every 15 minutes, just enforce state, make sure it looks like I've already got it configured. You can run it on demand. So, you can do it when you want to, or you can do it in response to something. So, spinning up a new VM, for example, you can kick it off right then. You don't have to wait for an interval. You can configure the schedule to run on the central server, the master. You can configure the schedule to run on the minion. So it just depends if you want it to be push or if you want it to be pull. In addition to that, you can kick off that process in response to real events. So you can monitor your web servers. And, load on your web servers, load on several of your web servers gets above some threshold, you can then use Salt to kick off some corrective action, like to bring up a new machine and bring it up to a known configuration and tie it into the load balancer.
So someone could say, to take something that doesn't quite happen like it used to, if someone were starting to get slashdotted, they could automate, a system to roll out, extra machines, add it to the load balancer to go, slash dot the finger and saying I'm not going down.
Exactly right. Yeah, it's just a matter of putting the reporting in the other place that you want to report. Are you interested in load? Are you interested in users coming through the load balancer and then writing a small script to aggregate that data and then make some determination based on that data. So if that data has certain properties, then kick off this process or kick off these series of processes.
Now, what technologies are Salt built on?
So Salt itself is written in Python, and for the transport layer, by default, we use 0MQ. If you'd rather use Salt without the additional agent, and you prefer to stick with SSH as your agent, we've got SSH as an optional transport.
All right. And if people want to get involved with Salt, learn about Salt, where should they go?
So saltstack.com is our main website, and from there we've got links to our documentation and to our GitHub page. Salt is all open source. It's Apache 2 on GitHub. And our documentation has contributor guidelines getting started. We've got pound salt on IRC on Freenode. And it's just as simple as diving in and scratching your own itch.
All right. And is there anything at this point you think I've missed that you would like the HPR audience to know?
It's not widely known that Salt is such an open-ended tool. We're often lumped into the same category as similar tools, but it is a very open-ended tool, and it's very good at solving problems, so I would invite people to dive into it and see where they can integrate with their existing tooling and what problems Salt can solve for them.
All right, and I think that's all the questions I have. Is there anything further you'd like to add?
Scale is awesome. It's one of our favorite conferences. It's been very good to us.
All right. Well, this has been Lord Drakenblut at Scale 13X talking with the folks from SaltStack.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the Binary Revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution ShareAlike 3.0 license.